Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is computer programming an art form? The countless lines of code that enable our devices to do what we want are largely invisible to most of us end users. But that doesn't discourage many programmers from striving to make those coded instructions perfect. Not simply functional, but flexible, elegant, even beautiful. Vikram Chandra is a novelist who for years paid the bills working as a computer programmer, which put him in the unique position to consider the similarities and differences between coding and art. His new work of nonfiction is called Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Code, The Code of Beauty. Vikram, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm pleasure to be here.
I know that many people are surprised to learn that you have had career success as both a computer programmer and as a novelist. But as you point out, both writers and coders really build worlds with language.
Yes. And I actually learned to program as a hobbyist. I was in a job in New York working as a kind of copyist, a scribe for a medical insurance company. And they got their first PCs. This was in the early 80s. And I discovered that there was a kind of orderly world in there with its own rules, and I could make it do things, which was very exciting. So I paid my way through the writing of my first novel by working as an independent consultant and programmer, sort of picking up things along the way.
Do you use your brain in just entirely different ways in those two vocations?
Well, I think they have certain similarities on the surface in that both are iterative processes. In other words, you write something, you look at it, you think it's ugly, you throw it away, and then you rewrite it. In both cases, you're trying to accomplish something, but the functionality that you're trying to get, I think, is very different. Code has to be very explicit. It has to be denotative. In other words, if the meaning of what you're writing in code ever becomes ambiguous, you're going to crash somebody's computer. You're maybe going to lose their banking data. You're going to let bad guys into their computer. So things are going to get very bad. And in fiction or in poetic language in general, what you're trying to do is to multiply meanings. Mm-hmm. In other words, in very good poetry, the surface, what it says in its denotative sense, is not the only meaning. There's lots of other implications. And as the famous writing program dictum has it, show, don't tell, right? So you, in a way, you're telling by not telling, by silence about what you're actually talking about. So I think they have similarities in that, like I was saying, you're dealing with language, you're handling tropes and language, you're trying to find clarity in both in a certain sense, but they also become very different as you head further along the path.
There is sort of an iceberg quality to both jobs, right? Programmers might have to spend far more time testing their work than actually writing the original code, just as a novelist or a poet spends a lot more time editing and rewriting that readers may never be aware of when they sit down and engage with that piece of work.
Yeah, exactly. So in terms of programming, I think readers are or users are completely hidden from the immense complexity of what goes on to do the simplest things on your phone. It's mind-bogglingly, dazzlingly powerful what happens because hardware has been expanding or getting more powerful at an exponential rate since the 40s. And what that means is that the most powerful computer in the world in 1984 was a Cray 2. It was called a supercomputer then. And the phone that you carry in your pocket today is as powerful as probably two of those.
Wow. Right?
So you're carrying a supercomputer in your pocket, and what the programmer does is utilize all that raw power to make those pretty little checkboxes on your screen and then make it do things. And so there's the immensity of programs is mind-boggling. Sometimes programmers like to say that what they're building are the largest artifacts that humanity has ever built. So for instance, let me see if I can find my exact number. There's a 5ESS switch, which is used in telephone exchanges, and it derives its functionality from 100 million lines of code.
Oh, my goodness.
There's a 2008 distribution of Linux that has 200 million lines of code.
Wow.
So you're dealing with immensities and complexities that a single human mind can't really understand very well, which is why teams of programmers work on even the simplest of projects.
I was going to ask, is code that is that elaborate, is that where code is messy and not beautiful? Or because maybe it is necessary to have that many lines of code, then it still passes the aesthetic test?
Well, no, ideally you would want all code to be beautiful. And when I say beautiful, what we're talking about is an aesthetics of functionality. And so to back up a little bit, it might seem strange, first of all, when we're talking about computer language, computer code, why we're talking about elegance and beauty. And the reason is that when you write code, you're not really writing it for the machine. The instructions that you're passing to the machine are almost incidental. Because 3 months from now, somebody else is going to have to open that file and read your code and understand it, right? Mm. So there's a premium on clarity, on expressiveness, and on building your architecture in such a way that people 20 years from now can look at it and understand how it actually works. And unfortunately, what happens is that often, even you, if you've written code 3 months ago, you look at it and you have no idea what it's doing, right? So imagine looking at something that somebody wrote 40 years ago and trying to understand that. And all of this is done under immense pressure of time and resources and budget, right? So you're trying to build elegant, clear code, but your boss is saying, just get it together and slap it on there and let's get our website running, right? And so you end up doing these things that you know are messy. Often when you read code, you will find comments left by programmers 10 years before saying, I know this is a hack, but I don't have time. This is how it's going to work. Right? So they're sort of warning you that it's really ugly. And so what happens over time, especially with very large programs, is that clarity and comprehensibility slowly disappears, and you end up with what, in the terms of the trade, is called a big ball of mud, in which there are components of code using each other promiscuously. You have no idea why something is happening in one part because it's being called by something else, you know, another 100,000 lines away. And that can result in completely inflexible and unfixable programs. So, for example, the U.S. Pentagon's Defense Finance and Accounting Service uses software that we know makes widespread errors in paying soldiers' salaries, right? Mm-hmm. And it's very hard to get them to actually fix the errors that are made when you get your paycheck. The trouble is that the software that they're using is about 7 million lines of COBOL code written mostly in the 1960s, and nobody understands how it works.
Wow.
There's a retired employee who is quoted as saying, it's hard to make a change to a program if you don't know what's in there. And the documentation disappeared long ago, right?
But they can't start over. They can't just scrap the whole thing and start over.
Well, you can, but it's immensely expensive, mm-hmm. right? So your options are either you patch things or you put in what programmers and engineers call kludges, right? You just sort of make it work somehow. Or you spend, say, $400 million on starting all over again, spending 10 years on writing the new system. And then you're still not guaranteed that at the end it'll actually all work in the way that it's supposed to.
When I was reading about that, I had a thought in my mind. I know nothing about programming computers, and I know very little about sewing. But a few years ago, I tried to make a quilt. And when you start off, all the pieces line up really well. But then the slightest little error in the second row causes much larger, you know, problems and ugly seams and everything, you know, 6 inches down. So that at the end, it's all completely uneven. And I suppose it's that way with computer code, right? A tiny little glitch at the very beginning can really reverberate for decades.
Right. It can. And sometimes you don't know a bug is there until decades later because the hardware environment changes, right? So you might have a line of code that contains a potential for error 10 years from now, and which is why testing is so important, because what you try to do is to write 10, 50, 100 tests for every 4 lines of code, making sure that under various conditions, it's still working the way that you want it to. So, there have been in recent history a couple of these episodes where something that was not a bug until now was discovered by somebody, and they used it as an exploit to get into people's systems, and all of a sudden, the entire world is falling apart. So, in all that complexity, there are glitches and there are potential for glitches, because these immensely complex things are interacting with each other in ways that you can't always predict, no matter how careful you try and be upfront.
So when you're working with a team and there are various coders that have taken segments of a project and they're working together, is it sort of easy to tell the ones who would like to think of themselves as artists? And I don't say that in a cynical way. I mean, they strive to do a sort of artistic, elegant sort of code. And the ones who are satisfied with a hack, are they easy to spot when you chat with them for 10 minutes?
Well, I don't know about easy to spot, but you get the general tendency of exactitude, which is a characteristic among everybody. You know, you want to be precisely so, and you want to know how it works. And in fact, you know, there's a kind of geek testing that goes on, especially among men, I think, or mostly among men, male programmers, when they first meet each other. You're trying to figure out, like, what the level of the guy's knowledge exactly is. And so people will throw out this lingo and see if you actually understand what you're saying. And there's a certain machismo connected to all of this, right? So that the more difficult problems that you can solve, the more sort of respect you get in a kind of manly way, right? The pressure, though, I mean, often those people in working in a large team can be an asset, but they can also be, given the pressures of time and of the venture capitalist breathing down your neck, wanting to get the website up and running, they can become a drag on the team, right? And every programmer has heard or been in a project where people spent so much time trying to think about how to make it beautiful that the project actually never was finished. It just sort of died because the budget got taken away. So nowadays, often the advice that you get is that let's just get a working version up and running, slap up the website, and when we find users, then we'll make it beautiful. Right?
Is that
so
how
at
you...
least the...
Oh, please continue. Sorry.
The idea is that you'll improve it sometime in the future, but often the technical debt you leave behind is too heavy. You're always trying to do new stuff. And so there's not time left to, fix the bugs, make the things better that you intended to make better in the first place. And so you end up, again, with a big ball of mud, finally.
We're speaking this hour with Vikram Chandra. He is a novelist and former computer programmer. His new nonfiction book is called Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Code, The Code of Beauty. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. Love to hear from some programmers about your approach to this question. You can also send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist and former computer programmer Vikram Chandra. His new book is called Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Code, The Code of Beauty. It's a work of nonfiction. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So Vikram, you were talking about, you know, the pressures that arise occasionally that require programmers to just slap it up, get it done, move on, fix bugs later. Now, it's got to be a different thing when you are writing a novel. There are surely some time and resource pressures, but it's a pretty solitary endeavor. How much does the process of slap it up, get that first draft done, remind you of what happens when you're working on deadline to finish a coding project?
This is why I don't work on deadlines when I write fiction. that's why, you know, I have a day job teaching at the University of California at Berkeley, is precisely because I don't want to be held to a deadline. So what I usually do is slap up a first dirty job, right? You get the manuscript out in some sort of shape, and that's for my eyes only. And then you revise and revise and revise, sometimes for years on end. And I'm particularly slow, but for instance, my last novel, Sacred Games, I probably worked on that for something close to 9 years. And it was 7 years before I had a draft that was ready to show to my then-girlfriend, now-wife, Melanie. And, you know, when we met me, I was already writing the novel, and she asked me, where are you in it? And I said, I'm in the middle. And then for the next few years, every time she asked me, I would say, I'm still in the middle. So the trouble also, or one of the qualities of writing poetic language, is that you can't test it, really.
Right.
The lovely thing about code is that at least you make it in small chunks, and then you can write a dozen tests for each of those little chunks to make sure that it's doing what you want it to do. And there's actually specialized programs, test runners, that run, you know, they'll run 40 tests on this particular bit of code, and each time a test passes, it'll put up a little green check mark on your screen. And if it fails, it puts up a little red cross, so you know you failed that test. And when the whole panel goes all green, there's such a lovely rush. But you can't do that in poetry or fiction. I mean, I can show it to Melanie, and she says, well, I think it works. But you're really writing for the readers of the future, and your ideal reader might not exist until 100 years after you're dead. So you're always working, in a sense, by instinct, and you finally have to make a decision, despite what your editor tells you or your reader tells you or your wife tells you, about how this sentence is going to hang together and whether it's doing what you think it ought to be doing.
Why does code, by its very definition, rely on synthetic languages rather than something closer to natural speech?
Well, the reason is that finally what you're sending to the central processing unit of your computer, your phone, whatever you're using, is a string of binary numbers, a stream of binary numbers, you know, zeros and ones strung together in a particular configuration that then sets off the logic gates inside your CPU, and then things happen inside your computer. So the first programmable computers, so to take, for example, the ENIAC, which was put into operation in 1945, you programmed it by switching these little electronic little banks of switches and then patching telephone cords from one socket to another. And all your program, you were literally building the program into the machine. Right? Mm-hmm. So it took you several days to first put the program in. You know, you attached all these patch cords and switched switches, and then it took you several days to test it. And that's how you program. So obviously that didn't seem too efficient, so people started trying to just write machine code, which is a hexadecimal representation of binary language. It uses letters and numbers to represent numbers. But even that is, if you look at that, it's very hard to read. So the desire always was to make, to be able to write text in a human-like language and then be able to send that to the computer and have it translated into the language of the machine, into binary numbers. So when people did that, you have to make a language that is so regular in its structure that when you pass it to the compiler, which is the specialized program that takes your line, say some, you write something like write line hello world, which will pop up hello world on your screen, it has to be in such a regular form that when the compiler slurps it up and sees those words, it knows what to do with it. So the syntax and the semantics of the computer languages has to be very formalized. It has to be very regular, as opposed to natural language, where if you change the order of certain words in a sentence, you and I will still understand what we're trying to say. Right?
There is at least one natural language that, based on a grammar that was written a long time ago, theoretically at least, is structured and regulated enough that it at least resembles computer code.
Yes. And it's quite an incredible connection. So the primary cosmopolitan language of the Indian subcontinent, as many people will know, was Sanskrit. And the earliest texts that are available to us in Sanskrit are from around 2000 BCE to 1500 BCE. The first one is the Rig Veda. These are wisdom texts, sort of revealed revelation texts. And the interesting thing about these was that it wasn't just the words themselves that were important. It was the order of the words. It was the specific tones that were important in them being effective. So in order to preserve all that language in a really tight way, the culture developed really sophisticated systems of linguistics and prosody and interpretation. And this all finally culminated in about 500 BCE when a grammarian named Panini wrote a grammar called the Ashtadhyayi, which literally means eight chapters. So we call it a grammar, but it's not really a grammar in the sense that you and I might understand that word today. It's not a paradigmatic grammar, which is to say that it doesn't have those verb declensions. You know, when you try and learn another language, you go teach, taught, you know, whatever, teaches. And you learn. You have to sort of mug up, learn by heart these incredibly annoying strings of verbs and how they decline. The Ashtadhyayi, on the other hand, is about 4,000 very economically defined rules. And when I say rules, I mean rules in the logical and perhaps mathematical sense. And when I say economical, I mean really short. You can print the whole thing out in about 40 pages of regular size text. So what happens in this system, in this machine, is that you take a verb root, and then depending on what you want to do with it, you feed the verb root, and certain rules start being set off. And rules can call other rules, and the verb root that you start with starts getting transformed. And finally, what pops out at the other end is a verb or a noun or a sentence, whatever you want. So in terms that contemporary computer programmers would understand it, this is a rule set. And it's an algorithmic rule set that produces language, that produces all the possible words of Sanskrit, which are infinite in number. So does that all make sense? It's an astonishing kind of feat of compression and of descriptive linguistics. It exactly describes the language in a way that no other language has ever been described since. So what happens with this is that it has a couple of interesting effects on Sanskrit itself, is that because it's so formalized, it stabilizes the language. So over the centuries, as we come down towards our own time, there are certain general trends. So that in the second millennium, there's a trend among stylish Sanskrit writers to use long compound words. There are sometimes regional differences and so forth. But if you write grammatically correct Sanskrit today and you sent it back by time machine 2,000 years, they would be able to read it. It's become, in a sense, a kind of formal artificial language. So what happens with this is that the Ashtadhyayi, Panini's grammar, gets discovered by the West in the 18th century, and it gets translated and slowly has this very wide influence in what we understand, what we know today as modern linguistics. So De Saussure, who is generally regarded as the father of structured linguistics, was a Sanskrit professor. The American linguist Leonard Bloomfield, who set the direction of American linguistics in the 20th century, was also a Sanskrit professor. And so when Chomsky, in his ideas about generative linguistics, is very influenced by this tradition as well. So in the late 1940s, when people are trying to make computer languages, they come to a way of defining or setting out the structure of computer languages in a form that is called the Backus-Knorr form. And that actually looks exactly like the Paninian form. So much so that, in fact, in the 70s, there was a programmer who wrote in to one of the primary journals of the technical establishment saying that it should actually be called Panini Backus form. So there's this weird connection between what we see today and this very ancient language.
What was Parnini's motivation? I mean, could he have seen the writing on the wall in terms of, you know, empires and conquests and the threats to the language that would come hundreds and thousands of years later?
I think this idea of preservation, right, and this idea of this very central idea that is, I think, becomes very powerful in the Indian philosophical and scientific tradition of finding an algorithmic way to explain the world. Or to explain anything, right? So the sutra form, Panini's these rules that are so tight and so compressed, they become the model for all further writing, especially of the scientific sort. So forever on since then, people are trying to find ways of, especially if you're writing in a way that you're trying to explain some phenomenon in the normal, in the regular world, you try and describe it in that kind of algorithmic way. And he succeeds, in a sense, in preserving the language of the Vedas, which is already 1,000 years or more behind him, because that's the sort of primary driving religious intent, is that you want to preserve that form. But also there's an intellectual argument to be made in terms of seeing language as a system that becomes very persuasive. And then within the Indian subcontinent, you know, it's a very multilingual culture. As you go from north to south, you every few hundred miles, the language changes. So Sanskrit then serves for a very long time as a cosmopolitan language of connection. And even beyond India, from Afghanistan to Bali, there's a kind of Sanskrit ecumene where people talk to each other in Sanskrit, even as they use other languages in the street that they walk on or at home.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Nels in Dallas. Hi, Nels.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Very well.
Thanks for taking my call. So I'd like to talk to the author. Is it Vikram?
Vikram.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned something earlier about economic pressures from a coding standpoint, right? So a lot of times you do the 80-20 rule, but me being a computer programmer for about 25 years, I know there's a lot of projects we put through exactly as you stated. They weren't really ready, but we just put them through. But I wanted to ask you a personal question. So now being an artist, a writer, whatever, I also do art of various sorts, and I've got tons of projects that I just never finish because mm-hmm. I can't find, like you're saying, that eloquent solution. So how do you, as a writer, overcome that where you're like, okay, it's good enough, or how many projects, I guess, do you have that are sitting on the table that you hadn't finished from an artistic standpoint?
Yeah, it's a really tough question. I think the French poet, Verlaine, I think, said it: "You never finish a project; you always abandon it." and there's a sense in which you just have to do that. I mean, you know, today is the day that the book officially releases in the United States, and when I look at it right now, there's some sentences I look at and I go, "Oh, I could have made those better. I could have said that better." So I suppose for me, there's a strange feeling of completeness that comes at a certain point in working on a book when I know that it's not perfect, it's not doing everything that I want it to do, but now it's ready to show to somebody else. And for me, that happens to be my wife and a couple of my friends. And then after spending some time with them, then I'm ready to send it on to, you know, the outside world, as it were, to my agent. And at some point, the velocity of that giving away tends to take over, right? Once the editors get their hands on it, you get deadlines settling in place. I'm sure that it's not a very helpful answer, but I think at some point you have to decide it's good enough, right? Or at least it's good enough to show to somebody that can then talk to you about what you're trying to do with it, and then for you to evaluate whether you want to work on it some more or not.
Well, it comes back to that issue of, you know, you can test to make sure that code works. No amount of testing will ensure you that a particular plot point or character or passage of text
right.
works equally well for every reader. It would be maddening to strive for, maybe not to strive for perfection, but to promise yourself you'll keep going until you are positive you've achieved it.
Yes. Yeah, I completely agree. And you know, history shows us this as well, that often, you know, one of my favorite American books, one of the first American books that I completely fell in love with was The Great Gatsby. And when you read its critical history, when it was released, it was murdered in the press. I mean, people absolutely hated it. And poor Fitzgerald died thinking he was a failure. And we now, I mean, I read that book now, and I try and read it once a year, at least every year. I think, how could people think that? It's astonishing to me. And then the converse also happens, right? That some book which is universally hailed as the greatest piece of fiction written in the last 20 years, and then, you know, 10 years later, it has no life. Nobody remembers it. So I think uncertainty is something that you must learn to live with in art, because you can never know. And so finally, you're doing it for yourself, and you're doing it for that ideal reader in the future.
Vikram Chandra is my guest. He's a novelist and former computer programmer. His new work of nonfiction is called Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Code, The Code of Beauty. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with novelist and former computer programmer Vikram Chandra, author of Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Code, The Code of Beauty. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Vikram, I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, which was this sort of hyper-masculine culture that we have built up in this country, at least, around coding. How did that happen when, in the days of ENIAC, it was all women that did the coding?
Right. So the first computers were actually quite literally women, right? So the history of the word is interesting in that in the 19th century, a computer was a person who sat and did calculations for logarithmic tables and so forth. And all of most of those were women. And so when people started trying to build mechanical devices to make those calculations happen, especially during the Second World War, the idea that programming would be hard had actually not occurred to anybody. So at the time that the ENIAC was set into operation, all the designers and the scientists who were known as the planners were male, and all the coders were women. And the coders were seen to be doing a job that was craft. It was mechanical. It wasn't actually creative. And so the idea was that the planner would make the program. In other words, he would write the data structures and the algorithms, and he would hand it off to the coder, who did a kind of secretarial service of translating it into the language of the machine by clicking switches and moving those patch cords from one place to another. So it's amazing to think this, but pretty soon everyone figured out that programming was actually pretty hard, and it was something that took skill and it took creativity and it took intelligence. And so slowly the profession was then seen as something quite valuable. But this happened over a couple of decades. And as late as 1967, Cosmopolitan magazine carried an article which was titled The Computer Girls, and which said, told everybody in quite a breezy fashion, there's no sex discrimination in hiring. Every company that makes or uses computers hires women to program them. If a girl is qualified, she's got the job. And they interviewed Admiral Grace Hopper, who wrote the first, you know, was a pioneer, wrote the first compiler. And she short told the Cosmo readers, it's just like planning a dinner. You have to plan ahead and schedule everything so it's ready when you need it. Programming requires patience and the ability to handle detail. Women are naturals at computer programming, end quote. So what happens is that as the profession gets professionalized, or this craft gets professionalized and made into something that's valuable and high-paying, it gets masculinized. And this happens in a couple of ways. There's a very good historian named Nathan Ensminger who's written a lovely book called The Computer Boys Take Over. And what he says is that masculinity becomes one of the ways in which any profession gets valued, right? So if you take something like cooking, but you're trying to make it high-paid and valuable, you then make it into chefdom, and that chefdom has masculinity attached to it, right? And so what he argues is that the same kind of thing happens in the realm of programming, is that in the United States especially, it becomes slowly converted into this very masculine, macho profession, and that also as the programmer becomes a valuable commodity, companies that are competing with each other try and find talented programmers. And the way they do it is by putting out these immensely hard logical and mathematical tests that often require a formal training in logic or mathematics. And so the people that they attract are men. And according to Ensminger, men of a certain time, he quotes an industry analyst from the 60s who argued that this Darwinian selection of personal profiling resulted in an influx of programmers who were often egocentric, slightly neurotic, and bordering upon a limited schizophrenia. The incidence of beards, sandals, and other symptoms of rugged individualism or nonconformity are notably greater among this demographic group. So I think, as Ensminger described it, it's kind of like a feedback loop, all right? Because mm-hmm. you're selecting for a particular kind of masculinity, you're emphasizing that in your materials. You attract those kind of men. You attract men in the first place, and you attract a certain sort of ethos among those men. And then this sort of feeds into itself, and it keeps getting stronger and stronger. And I guess I should point out that the history in other parts of the world is different. And the one that I know particularly about is in India, where computers were introduced in the early 60s. Important into the subcontinent, into the very elite Indian institutes of technology, right? And what everyone is trying to do is build up an economy which has been shattered by colonialism. But computing doesn't get masculinized in the same way there. So we have this very interesting situation where on every other index, India is far behind the United States in terms of access to women, right? So the 2012 survey of women's access to security, to education, and so forth rates the United States at 22nd in the world, and India comes in at a completely dismal 105. But there are more women programmers in India as a proportion than there are in the United States. And in some senses, it's seen as the ideal job for a woman because it takes place in an office. It's a safe environment. It pays comparably. And so there's a very strong gender-neutral urge within the culture in terms of at least this job. And a couple of other jobs like it. Banking, for instance, which, you know, as we know in the United States, is the realm of the Wolf of Wall Street, you know, the masters of the universe, in India is dominated by women. The state-owned banks owned by women control 45% of all Indian public sector bank deposits and 50% of all loans. And many of the largest private banks are CEO'd and managed by women. And again, it's worked in the same way, that somehow that skill of handling money, of mathematics, is not seen as a masculine skill, right?
We have an email here from Jason in Grapevine who wants to know what your favorite programming language is.
That's a very good question. Well, I sort of spent my entire life in the Microsoft languages. Most recently, I suppose, was C#. But I've recently been trying to get away from that. And so I'm currently learning Clojure, which is a kind of Lisp, as your emailer will obviously know. And I'm having one of those conversion moments. It's kind of hard to describe to the non-programmer, but Lisp is a very old language. It's the second oldest language invented in the 1950s. And it has a very peculiar syntax, a very regularized syntax. And it never dominates because the syntax is so strange, but it never dies because it's such an amazing language. So yes, Clojure is my current obsession.
And for writing prose, have you always preferred English?
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's one of those historical events in India is that so after Sanskrit, for a few hundred years, especially in the north of India, Persian becomes the cosmopolitan language as the courts, the royal courts, which are the sponsors of language in a sense, become partially Muslim or to some extent Muslim. And then the next sort of big language switch at the very top happens when the British come in and English becomes the language of commerce, of politics, of international communication. So I grew up in a multilingual universe. I spoke Hindi at home and English at school. And so when I first started to write fiction, which was when I was a really little kid, I started writing very Isaac Asimov-y science fiction in English, as often do. So, I mean, it's for many people of my generation and after, English is just another Indian language mm-hmm. that we use. And in some certain demographic ways, that is becoming increasingly true. We're not quite sure that it's happened yet, but very soon, Indians will be the largest number of English speakers in the world, right? Out of a billion people, billion odd people, if a few percent speak English, that's already very large numbers.
Sure. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Jerome in Fort Worth. Hi, Jerome.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm listening to this conversation, fascination. I'm one of the developers of the COBOL programming language, which was first created in 1960. And the author, I'm sure, knows that there's still many, many lines of COBOL mm-hmm. code in running our business world around the world today. And the reason for that is that when the author speaks of beauty in code, it is very different than beauty in prose. Beauty in mm-hmm. code has to do with clearness, clarity, not cleverness. And that is how COBOL is distinguished from many other languages, because it's not supposed to be a clever language. It is supposed to be a clear language, exactly mm-hmm. for the reason that the author mentioned.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Jerome. What do you think about that, Vikram?
I think that's exactly right. In some sense, COBOL, in historical terms, is like a Mesopotamian dialect almost, you know, in terms of its age, in terms of the speed with which things change in the world of technology. And yet, it still processes 90% of the planet's financial transactions and 75% of all business data. I mean, it's just amazing. And you can make actually a very decent living today just by being a COBOL programmer. Your caller is exactly right, is that cleverness or expressivity in computing means something very different. And the values by which you judge a piece of code as to its beauty is an aesthetics of functionality and long-term functionality. So, I completely agree with him.
As you know, we're so late in the game in this country to understanding the importance of speaking more than one language. And so now, as you know, American children speak English, there are questions about whether the second language should be Spanish or maybe Chinese. Is it important for literate people to have some basic familiarity with computer languages and how they work?
I would say yes, in the same way that you familiarize kids. My daughter's in first grade, and you know, she's learning about science. She's learning about how nature works, and she's also starting to get an education in how to use computers. And so, I think to be educated in a full sense, it would be a good idea to have some sense of the algorithms that are completely running our world, that are contained in our pockets, that shape the way that we see the world. And I'm convinced, and I'm going to sound like a science fiction idealist here, but I think we're going to start wearing computers in our clothes. And I think, you know, the Google Glass kind of interface where your reality is going to be mediated in an even more closer sense by computing is right around the corner. It's much closer than we might think. So I think absolutely that we have to give people the opportunity to know how things work. But I don't think that means that, it should be some sort of required subject that should be crammed down everyone's throat. I think the opportunity to learn how to use a computer in coding terms would be something that you offer to people just as you offer all the other facilities in an education. I should say also that I think one of the failures that programmers realize intensely is that programming is still really, really hard. Mm-hmm. Right from the earliest moments in the 50s, there always has been this promise that any moment now somebody is going to offer a language that business people will be able to use to write little programs that will give them statistics and information and so forth. And COBOL, in a sense, was actually supposed to be one of those great hopes, right? It was a business language that was supposed to enable not your your sort of bearded coder, but your civilian. But I think we've still not come to that point at all. There's too much ceremony required to do the simplest things. And I think that needs to be worked on a lot harder.
Vikram Chandra is a novelist and former computer programmer. His new work of nonfiction is called Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Code, The Code of Beauty. Vikram, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Alsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.